cats are still mostly wild genetically, but we force them to live like they're fully domesticated. That's stressful for cats and owners. Could training be the answer?
So with all this change in role has come these things that we now expect cats to do, to go in the cat carrier, to go to the veterinarian office, to come in at night time. And suddenly we find actually it's quite difficult to get cats to do those things. But it needn't be, because we can train them.
That's cat behaviorist Sarah Ellis. She's the co-author with John Bradshaw of The Trainable Cat, a practical guide to making life happier for you and your cat. Then the election is finally over, but with a shocking result that few in the chattering classes foresaw. But the signs were there for those unburdened by the blinders of privilege to see. We re-air our interview with one of them, cartoonist Ted Rall, about his graphic biography of Donald Trump, first broadcast in August. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and on the web at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Dogs have owners, cats have staff, right? The whole notion that you can train a cat may seem preposterous, especially to those who take the view that cats are diabolical manipulators who make their humans into putty in their paws. But my guest, Sarah Ellis, says cats are trainable, and training them is important for the mental health of our companion kitties as well as for ourselves. Many cats are now confined indoors their whole lives to protect them from traffic or to protect birds from them. Others are shut in at night to keep them safe from predators. And while a dog's place is with its owner, cats are highly territorial and feel comfortable only at home. Hence the struggles over getting them into cat carriers and the howls of protest that endure throughout the car ride to wherever we're taking them. Sarah Ellis and her co-author biologist John Bradshaw, he wrote the best-selling book Cat Sense, show how easy and fun it is to train cats once we understand their true nature. Sarah Ellis, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Hello, thank you.
Your book, The Trainable Cat, a practical guide to making life happier for you and your cat, came as a surprise to me because I thought, like I think many people, that cats are untrainable. You know, the idea dogs have people, cats have staff?
Yeah.
So cats are trainable?
Yes, they are. Yeah, they completely are. And I totally understand where you're coming from. It's a belief that lots of people have. And it's partly, I think, come about because, one, we haven't recognised maybe the need to train cats. Previously, if we look back historically, cats lived very much sort of on the periphery of our lives. Rodent catchers often put out at night. Now they're very much a cherished member of the family, often sleeping in our bedrooms, on our beds, even in our beds. And with that change in role has come the need to make sure that they're well looked after and that they have good veterinary care. And there are in some countries there are now pressures to make sure that you keep your cat inside at nighttime. And so with all this change in role has come these things that we now expect cats to do, to go in the cat carrier, to go to the veterinarian office, to come in at nighttime. And suddenly we find actually it's quite difficult to get cats to do those things. But it needn't be, because we can train them. And I think the second thing is we haven't really recognised that they can be trained, because they're not necessarily as socially motivated to be around us or to please us as dogs traditionally are. And that's come from their evolution, from having evolved from a solitary ancestor. But that doesn't mean to say that they don't learn in exactly the same way as a dog or any other mammal. It just means that we have to make sure that we've got other rewards beyond things that are social.
So what are some of the rewards that really motivate a cat?
Food. Every owner will know that their cat loves food. And actually, because if we look at the ethology of how cats would eat when they're free ranging, they're the perfect animal to train, because as a hunter, and a hunter of small prey, a solitary hunter that would catch small rodents, they eat small meals often. So as opposed to having one large meal a day, they feed in these sort of small portions, little and often. And that's perfect for training, because in training, we want to be able to have the opportunity to reward lots of good behavior. And that's done by giving lots of little and often, little and frequent pieces of food. So food is by far the greatest motivator and our best tool for training cats. But for other cats, play is also really, really rewarding and reinforcing. And even although I've said as a whole, as a species, cats are not necessarily as socially motivated as other pets such as dogs, within that species there are individuals that are very, very social and will find attention from us as in the form of, for example, being scratched under their chin, rewarding, and rewarding enough that they are motivated to work for it. Then there's all the quirks of the individual cats. My cat Cosmos very much likes to facial rub on a grooming brush, and that is rewarding enough for him that he will work to do that.
It's interesting. I have a cat who I got at 4 months old. I was told that she had been brought in from the wild. It took quite a while to socialize her, but she has become so social that it is surprising to me. And I did figure out very early on that she was able to learn her name. So I wanted to ask you, you know, so many of us do get cats and kittens that, you know, have been brought into shelters. Talk a little bit about, you know, the kitten and what kinds of things can make a kitten more amenable to being trained, no matter where they've come from.
Okay. There's two things there. Firstly, you're really lucky that your cat has been turned into a really sociable cat, because having come from the wild, it's likely that its parents were feral, were not pet cats. And therefore, we know cats that have genetics from feral, from untamed cats, from wild cats, are less likely to show social behaviour. The way that we can help them and train them to realize that people are actually friendly and nothing to fear is to make sure that we get early socialization into these kittens. Kittens are most receptive to learning about the world around them, including the social world, from about 2 to about 7 weeks of age. It's what we call a sensitive period. So for individuals, it will vary slightly. So I know you said you didn't get your kitten until he was 16 weeks, did you say?
Yeah, she was 4 months, yeah.
And therefore, they are still receptive to learning at that time, but they're not in the real peak period where those brains are really plastic. But for any kitten, to make sure it's most amenable to training, we want to make sure that it's not scared of people and that it's had lots of gentle but positive experiences of meeting different people in that early period from about 2 weeks onwards. If a kitten does not have that, then if that kitten is from wild parentage, that kitten will remain feral for the rest of its life. It may be possible to tame it and to accept one or two people that it lives with, but it won't view all the visitors to the home as positive people. So early socialization is the key to that animal learning that people are positive, and then also making them much more receptive to training later on.
Well, she must be a remarkable cat, because she's very, very friendly. And since I've been actually following some of the precepts that we'll be talking about that you discuss in this wonderful book, The Trainable Cat, I found that she loves to be trained. And so actually, it's not even a chore necessarily. A cat, it seems to me that she derives real pleasure from our training sessions.
That's really lovely to hear, and I'm actually hearing that quite a lot from owners, which is, it's really nice. It's my reward, if you like. And yeah, for me, that's not surprising, because I've been doing it for so many years with my cats. But I think a lot of owners have gone into it thinking, I've got a duty of care to do this because I don't want my cat to be stressed, but it might be a bit of a chore. It's another homework task, and it doesn't need to be at all. But as soon as they quickly see how much their cat enjoys it and how it starts to change their relationship with their cat, because their cat starts to perceive them differently, wants to be around them more, is more engaging, it becomes so rewarding for cat and owner. And it becomes a bit addictive then. You're sort of ready to teach the cat the new thing. And certainly my cat's always around me going, hey, what are we going to do? We're going to do some training now. And it can really, really enhance that relationship.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with the cat behaviorist, Dr. Sarah Ellis, about the book she co-authored with John Bradshaw, The Trainable Cat. Now, I think before I came across your book, I was clueless about any kind of training. And so there were times in which I would yell at her when she did something wrong and she'd run out of the room. And I thought, well, you know, that's great. She's learning that she shouldn't do it. Talk about punishment and how that's maybe a no-no.
Okay. So exactly. If you yelled at your cat for doing something you didn't want her to do, let's say it was, clawing the furniture, the act of you shouting in a loud voice, as you've rightly said, stops her doing that behavior. And makes her leave the room. But it doesn't, it doesn't stop the motivation to perform that behavior. What she might learn to do instead is to do the behavior when you're not around, but still scratch the furniture. Or she might find an alternative place. But the most important thing from a welfare point of view is that she does not differentiate in her mind, you are just shouting at me because I scratched that furniture. She thinks in her mind, wow, sometimes you shout at me. And that's actually quite a scary thing. And therefore, I'm not sure when you're going to shout at me. So I'm not sure I want to be around you at all anymore. And I actually feel a bit anxious in your presence. So yes, we might be able to stop the behavior if we're lucky. But at the same time, we're really damaging our relationship with our cats and potentially putting our cats into a constant state of generalized anxiety. And that's a complete no-no from our welfare point of view. No owner wants that for their cat.
And I think that points up one of the other, you know, central ideas of your book, and that is that training is a way to help cats adapt to an unnatural environment for them. Is that right?
Completely, yeah. I mean, we have to accept with the cat, we have not fully domesticated it to the same extent that we have domesticated pet dogs. So we have an animal that is still very capable of living without us, living within our homes. And because we're still on that sort of cusp of domestication with this animal, we've never artificially selected for traits that would make it genetically adaptable for this life. So instead we have to train it. So there are many things that we expect cats to do that their natural biology has not set them out to do. For example, traveling in fast motion cars within cat carriers is not something natural for a cat. So therefore, I believe we have a duty of care to teach it that this should not be something that is frightening for a cat.
Well, that's the perfect place to then introduce the 9 skills that form the foundation for training cats. We may not get to all 9 of them, but I wanted to do it within the context of the cat carrier.
Okay.
My cat, when I brought her home, when she was just a little fluff, and she was in the carrier that the shelter had, by the time I got home, which was about a 15-minute car ride, the carrier was utterly demolished. And she has really hated, I mean, now she's 4 years old, she really, really hates to go in the cat carrier. And I had just despaired of ever being able to train her to do that. So I did try to, you know, put in treats, but she completely ignored the treats. And then I tried taking it apart and putting treats in that way, and she still completely ignored the treats. I do have to say that following your plan, she is now sleeping in the bottom half of her cat carrier.
That's lovely to hear.
So we have some success. But put this in the context of the skills. If you know, what would be with a cat that is so averse to something like a cat carrier, what are the foundational skills that you would use to train the cat to be more friendly toward it?
Okay, so if we're starting off with a cat that's already fearful of the cat carrier, the first thing I would suggest is that you change the cat carrier, because that relationship of being associating the cat carrier with negative events such as traveling, going to the vets, going to the boarding cattery, has going to have been built up over a long period of time and is going to be really, really well established. So we're going to have a better chance of getting the cat to accept going in a cat carrier if we use a brand new cat carrier. That also means we've got a carrier that isn't full of the scent that the cat produces when it's scared. So cats have scent glands in between their toes, behind their cheeks, behind their whiskers on their cheeks, sorry, in front of their ears on those bald patches and under their chin. And one of the key skills is about impregnating scent, that cats produce certain chemicals known as pheromones that they facially rub on objects and deposit these pheromones, and that makes them feel safe and secure. But they also can produce another kind of pheromone when they are frightened. And so we want to get rid of any of those smells, because if the cat smells a carrier and it has got a scent in it that suggests to the cat it was scared the last time it was in there, it's not going to want to go anywhere near that again. So let's start with a brand new cat carrier, and let's use the key skill of impregnating it with the cat's scent. So we do that by just putting on a very fine cotton glove and stroking your cat around those facial regions, scratching under the chin if that's what your cat enjoys, or rubbing along the side of its cheeks, or stroking the top of the head. Then we take that glove and then we rub it all over the inside and the outside of the cat carrier. So we're not taking the cat over to the cat carrier at all. They don't even have to be in the same room at this point. We're simply just trying to get the cat's scent onto the carrier. Then what we want to do is break the carrier down into its simplest form, as you said. So make sure that we've just got the base of the cat carrier. So we've purchased one that is the top can be completely removed. And we want to place that in the home in a place that is considered by the cat to be safe and secure, a nice quiet spot, not somewhere that they would, if they were in the carrier, they would get easily startled. So not near a front door or a washing machine or anything like that. And then our key skill number one described in the book is to allow voluntary exploration. Now, when we say exploration, we are not expecting this cat to march straight up to that cat carrier and give it a good sniff, not if it's had a previous negative experience of cat carriers. We might, at this stage, our exploration might simply be a fleeting glance in the direction of that cat carrier, and that we would reward. And what we do is we then reward by something called shaping, which is rewarding successive approximations of this final behaviour that we want. In our case, it's to get the cat voluntarily going into the cat carrier. So initially, we might just reward a tiny glance at the cat carrier. And then if at some stage the cat looks at it for longer, we reward that. If they move in a direction closer to it, we reward that, and so forth, until we're moving towards the cat being closer and closer to the cat carrier. For a cat that's previously been scared of the cat carrier, I wouldn't use lures, and lures are where you use food or another reward and move it in the direction of the cat carrier to entice the animal towards it. And the reason I wouldn't do that is, one, it might not work, as you experienced with your cat, by just placing food in the carrier and hoping it will go there. But secondly, if the cat does follow the food may be that enticing that it follows the food into the cat carrier. And then once the food is gone, as inevitably will happen, the cat will think, oh, crumbs, I'm in the cat carrier. How on earth did I get here? And it can't actually cope with being in the cat carrier without the distraction of constant supply of food. So instead, we need to use this shaping procedure, where at each stage, the cat is making the active choice to go closer to the carrier and is rewarded for it and is having time to take in information and process that information without the distraction of food.
Okay, so then the next one is marking behavior, but that would be putting her scent, is that right?
It's marking a behaviour. No, so we would say about impregnating the scent, collecting the scent and impregnating it. Marking a behaviour is, I'll give you an example. Let's say that you've got the cat carrier out in the living room and you're sat at the other side of the living room and your cat comes into the room and goes into her cat carrier. And you think, oh, crumbs, she's done the behaviour I want her to do. It's brilliant. She hasn't done it before. I need to give her her food reward straight away. But you realise you don't have any food rewards on you at that time because you weren't even expecting her to come into the room, let alone into the cat carrier. So you dash out the room and you get some rewards and you come back into the room and she's no longer in her cat carrier anymore. And you think, blast, I've missed my opportunity. What we can do instead is we can use a marker to mark that behaviour, to say, that was the behaviour that I wanted. Thank you. Well done. And now will come a food reward. So you're buying yourself a little bit of time. And the marker that I most commonly use is just the word good. So if Cosmos goes into the cat carrier on the other side of the room, the moment he's in, I can say to him, good. And he knows that was the behaviour that is going to be reinforced and reinforcement is on its way. What I should say is that initially in your training, the cat will have no idea that the word good means that a reward is going to come. You have to do a separate session of pairing the word good, giving some food, pairing the word good, giving some food, and doing that several times so that the cat learns the association. And you'll know that they've learned it because when you say the word good and they suddenly orientate their head towards you in that anticipatory fashion that they're expecting food, then you know they've learned that relationship. And then you can put your marker word into action.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with cat behaviorist Dr. Sarah Ellis about the book she co-authored with John Bradshaw, The Trainable Cat. Now, how about bringing another cat into the house? It's not something you really do for the cat's sake, but it is something that often humans will do for their sake, either because they think the cat needs a friend or because they want another cat.
Yeah, completely. People say to me, oh, I love cats so much. I'm so pleased to meet somebody else who loves cats. And I say, yeah, how many have you got? And then they'll say 6 or 7. And I think, eek. And they're always surprised to hear, you know, how few cats I have. Sadly, love doesn't always equate good welfare. And just because we love cats doesn't mean that we should have many. If we really love cats, let's have few. And in many cases, we should just have one because some cats cannot cope with living with others. So yeah, I'd love to demyth this idea that a cat needs a friend. It's not necessarily the case. And for the majority of cats, it really isn't the case. We can teach cats to live alongside other cats and they may become friends. But I would say there's a large number of cats out there who tolerate living with other cats rather than enjoy living with other cats. And that is partly down to poor choice, choosing incompatible cats, and partly down to the way that they were introduced. If I use a human analogy, if I may, imagine a situation where we came home one day from work and there was a stranger sleeping in our bed. We would be very, very very surprised to find that person, but we would also be very, very wary of that person. And then if, you know, our partner came home from work and said, oh, this is my friend and he's going to be living with us now, you're not going to just accept that. You're going to be very wary. Now imagine a different scenario where your partner came home from work and said to you, I have a friend and they're needing a place to live for a few weeks or a few months. How would you feel about if they came to live with us? First of all, why don't we just invite them round for dinner? And then maybe we'll just try a weekend of them staying. And if that works out, then maybe they can stay for a few weeks. We would be much more receptive to the latter example. And that person definitely sleeping in the spare room, not sleeping in our room. So you can imagine that's a little bit how it is for cats. They don't get to choose that this cat that they do not know is coming into their home. And they are very, very reluctant to share the resources that they have, their litter tray, their food bowls, their sleeping places, with a complete stranger. Cats in the wild, free-ranging domestic cats, only really live in groups that are familial. It's the females that tend to live together in social groups, and that's only when there's enough resources to support a group. So we're talking about mothers, sisters, aunties, grandmothers, etc. And the juveniles. When those males reach sexual maturity, they will disperse. They'll not stay within that group. So we can start to understand naturally why unknown, unrelated cats wouldn't find themselves living together. But it's a situation we create, and our cats are plastic enough that for some of them, we can teach them to accept a new cat. But the way we've got to do that is using a key skill called desensitization. And that is that instead of just thrusting that cat in front of the other cat, we need to introduce them to each other very, very gradually and one sense at a time. So these cats should be fully accustomed and comfortable with the smell of each other before they have even caught sight of each other, because smell is one of the most important senses to cats. Then they should be fully comfortable with seeing each other through a barrier without the ability to touch one another. They will be able to also hear each other at that time. And only once they're fully comfortable with all of those are they actually allowed to be in the same physical room. All the time through these gentle, graduated exposures, we are rewarding relaxed behaviour in the presence of the other animal. And we find that if that first introduction goes well, the cats are much, much more likely to form a good relationship long term. If the first introduction is negative, then those cats are going to find it much, much harder to get on. So this gradual process through rewarding, calm and relaxed behaviour is the best approach to go to try to make sure they do have a good long term relationship with one another.
And are your cats friends?
I only have one cat at the moment. Very sadly, I lost Herbie last year, but I did introduce Herbie to Cosmos as an adult, and they were very good friends. I have lots of photographs of them curled up together. We followed the exact procedure that was in the book, and I was very careful about how I selected those two cats and the time that I introduced them. We are about to get another kitten, and we're very fortunate that we have a house with lots of rooms, and it's very easy to segregate the house into different areas so each cat can have its own area before they are introduced. And my husband has just made a very beautiful mesh door so that we can do that gradual introduction process where the kitten and the cat can Cosmos cat can see one another without meeting. So Cosmos I've had since he was only a few days old. And because throughout his life he has experienced other cats coming in right from a young age, he has learned that is of no threat to him. He's always had plenty of resources. It's always been very, very controlled. And because it's been a part of his life from day one, he has accepted that that's what life is about. Whereas of a cat that has lived 10 years with never even encountering another cat, and the owner suddenly decides to bring in a kitten, that's a completely different story.
Sarah Ellis. Stay tuned for more of our conversation about training cats after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with cat behaviorist Sarah Ellis about training cats and how that makes life easier for pet cats as well as their owners. One command that's good for a cat to learn is to come when you call, whether or not your cat goes outside. Now, you mentioned that different cultures have different attitudes towards cats being indoor or out. In the United States, you're always being warned about the dire consequences of allowing your cat to go outside. However, I really feel that a life for a cat who has been outside is probably not worth living if they can't go outside again. So what are some of the things that people can do to make sure that their cat stays safe outside?
Yeah, that's really refreshing to hear. And I completely agree. I think that sadly for cats that have had outdoor access and then that outdoor access is thwarted, that's probably the most frustrating situation for a cat. Dare I say, even more frustrating than for a cat who has never experienced outdoors.
That's why I early on taught my cat her name, and I rewarded her every time she came in, although your book says you should probably reward intermittently, that's even better. But what are some things that are some ways to make sure that a cat stays safe that you allow outside?
Sure. So I can talk from real experience from this, because I have lost cat in the past to a road traffic accident, and it is absolutely devastating. But I'm a firm believer in quality of life over quantity of life. But we have tried to put in as many measures as possible to make sure that our cats are safe. And the first one I always do, as you've said, is to teach a cat a really strong recall. With our dogs, we would not let our dogs off lead if we didn't know that we could call them and get them back. And it's funny that yet we are happy to let our cats outside with no power or way of getting them back in if we want to. But cats actually respond really, really well to recall training. And so it's the very first thing I teach all of my cats, even if those cats do not get outside. And I'll give you a classic example. We've not long moved into this house that we're in now, and it's an old Victorian house, and it has old exposed floorboards. And we were having some work done, which involved the floorboards being taken up so the pipes could be accessed. And I didn't know that the heating engineer was going to lift the floorboards. And just before I left work, I heard him saying, "Oh no, Sarah, can you come upstairs a minute, please?" And the cat had gone under the floorboards. And he said, "Oh, this has happened in so many houses." And then we're like days with the floorboards up because the cat won't come out. And I said, "It's not a problem." And I called Cosmos's name and I gave his recall cue, which has come. And a little head popped out from under the floor and Cosmos came over and I gave him a stroke. And that was it. The floorboard could go back down. And the heating engineer said to me, "How on earth did you do that?" So to me, it really hit home, actually. This is not just as important for a cat that goes outside. This is just as important for cats that live indoors too. But yeah, going back to the outdoors, the recall is the first thing I would teach. And you teach that initially in the home, within the same room, with the cat just a meter away from you. And you build it up that you can do it from one end of the room to the other. And then from when you're within a different room in the house, so you're calling the cat from out of sight. And then eventually within the garden and in different directions. You must generalize your training, because if you only ever teach a command in one place, or only one person ever gives the command, you're going to find when you try and use it in a different place, or your husband or whoever calls your cat in instead of you, it's not going to work if you haven't practiced that generalization during the training. So that's the first thing I taught Cosmos. The second thing that I taught Cosmos was that if he wanted to leave our garden in our old house, he was going to come with me, or I was going to come with him. And therefore I taught him to walk with me. And I did that very simply by the fact of, why would you want to go over in that direction when you can come over in this direction with me, where there's going to be food rewards and there's going to be playing games with fishing rod toys? That's much more fun than going over to the other end of the car park where there's really not that much stuff to do. And the third thing I did, which is not so much a training task, but the cat is, of course, learning all the way through it. So in essence, you are training the cat, is I started to play with Cosmos outside. I don't know many owners that play with their cats outside. I know many dog owners that will take their dog out in the garden and throw a ball for their dog outside. But most cat owners just play with their cats inside. They keep the fishing rod toys, you know, the wand toys with the something on the end that the cat can chase. They keep them inside. They never take them outside. And I thought, well, I want Cosmos to be outside. I want him to enjoy the outdoors and to be able to run up trees and have those mad moments where they dart around. But I don't want him wandering that far out with our garden, because there are roads at our previous house not that far away. And so I thought, if he's going to go out in the garden, I'll come out too and we'll play some games. And since I started doing that with Cosmos, and I'll admit it's not something I did in the early days with Cosmos. Cosmos is, he's going to be 8 this year. So it's not something I did in the early years with him. It was something I did more in the latter years when I lost his brother to the road. And so at that time, Cosmos did used to have, I knew he would travel quite far from the garden. And I thought that this can't be the case anymore. I cannot risk losing him. And so by the very act of playing with him in the garden, When Cosmos goes out now, at our old house, he had free choice to leave the garden if he wished, but he very rarely did. I had a GPS collar on him for a year, and he never really went beyond two or three gardens. He was always hanging around, and if I went out and I called him, he would jump out from next door's garden. And I genuinely think it's because he thought, there's good stuff that happens in my garden. I don't want to be that far away because I might miss out. And the only downside to that is often when I let him outside, and if I was sat, I used to have my desk at the window over the garden so I could watch him while I was working. Often I would let him out and he would come and sit on the windowsill and meow from outdoors to inside at me as if to say, come out, we've got some playing to do. But he stayed safe, and that was the main thing. And again, it really enhanced our relationship, and it was another wonderful opportunity to play with him and let him explore the garden in a safe way.
That's wonderful. So do you have a case of, you know, well, of course, there are no bad cats, but the most difficult case maybe that you might think of, that you might have come across in your work, Sarah Ellis, where you used the principles in the trainable cat to solve the problem?
So I don't see behavior problems anymore. I did a long time ago, but I don't now. I work for a charity called International Cat Care. So I'm not dealing with cats and their owners on an everyday basis. But I can think of lots of examples where training can be used, and I can think of examples where I have had to help people, definitely. I can think of a case recently that last year I helped in a shelter in the UK where a number of cats came in together, and one of those cats was really, really overweight. And it's really, really difficult in the shelter environment to get a cat to lose weight because they just don't have that much physical space. And the other big problem there is that the boredom can also cause overeating in cats just as it can in humans. And so the shelter staff had tried many things with this cat to try and get him to lose weight, because nobody wanted him either because he was so overweight, and nothing was really working. And I was doing some staff training anyway at that organization. And so we started to talk about introducing a training protocol into his daily routine, that actually he got no free access food, that he never got food just out of a bowl. And we combined two things. The way that he got any amount of food was either through a puzzle feeder or either through training. So he had to physically work for every bit of food that he got. And we did lots of different kinds of training. We did recall training, we did high fives, we did jump up on the platform. You know, you have to go and sit on this mat or sit on this shelf if you want one piece of food. And then when your reward comes, it's going to be tossed in the other direction and you have to run down to get it, etc. That made that cat lose weight. And that no doubt made that cat's welfare better. It wasn't just about weight loss for him. It was also about his general apathy. That was a cat that, if didn't have an intervention, was going to go downhill pretty quick in that shelter environment. That cat's now in a home, and that cat's still doing training, and that cat is still losing weight. So it's a really nice story, really.
Oh, that is a great story. Well, Sarah Ellis, we could go on and on. Your book is just absolutely terrific, especially for us cat owners, but it's a fascinating book in any case. Thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
No problem.
Sarah Ellis is the co-author with John Bradshaw of The Trainable Cat, a practical guide to making life happier for you and your cat. She works for the charity International Cat Care and studies cat behavior at the University of Lincoln in the UK. Go to writersvoice.net to see a video clip of her cat, Cosmos. Back when we first aired the following interview with cartoonist Ted Rall about his graphic biography of Donald Trump, I said, if you believe current forecasts, Donald Trump isn't all that likely to become president of the United States in November. Well, November has come, and I guess I should not have believed those forecasts. Perhaps if the pollsters and pundits who made them had consulted Rawls' book, they might not have been so delusionally confident. Some see Trump's rise as a sign of encroaching fascism, allowing extreme right-wing views about immigrants and Muslims to gain wide currency. But while Trump's message of hate and intolerance excited a portion of his base, is it really the main reason for Trump's triumph? We should remember that Bernie Sanders remains the most popular politician in America, and his poll numbers against Trump always had a much wider margin of success than Clinton's. Maybe we need to look beyond the hatred to another key factor, the destruction of good jobs and the disappearance of the middle class. Ted Rawls' political biography of Trump is an antidote to the media's failure to understand what is behind the Trump phenomenon. Here's an edited version of our conversation. I told Ted Rawl about a story I'd heard about Terre Haute, Indiana, a place whose voters almost always pick the winning president. This year, pollsters are finding it's Trump, although Sanders also had a lot of support before he dropped out. Voters cited the fact that Terre Haute used to have good